before we start, the following story contains a moment or two that's pretty intense and may not be suitable for young kids.
Yeah, you're right. Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All
right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radio
from
WNYC.
Yeah.
Rewind.
Yeah, so Peter.
Yeah.
Matt.
Yeah.
Where do you want to launch into this?
Yeah, we're going to start with this call.
Tuesday, August 8, 2017.
This is a call from Bath County, Eastern Kentucky.
13:51 and 26 seconds.
It's a call from dispatch to the Bath County EMS station.
These are the people that are dispatched to medical emergencies.
Best I can remember, it was like 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, something like that.
Tones went off for a unresponsive male.
All right, so that's Scotty Whiteman.
Yep. The other voice is Jay Foe.
We're partners in EMS service in Bath County, Kentucky.
Anyway, call comes in.
First one of the day.
Scotty and Jay hop in their ambulance, and they rush over to this apartment complex. They've been there before. It's this sort of squat, two-story building.
Like a strip mall, almost.
When we get there,
jump out, put the gloves on, enter this small apartment.
And immediately when they come in, off to the left is the living room.
Law enforcement's there.
The chief of police was there, talking to the two people that were alert in the house, a woman and a guy
who are sitting on a couch.
And then if you look immediately to the right, it's just like the kitchen is there.
And that's where Scotty and JC,
lying on his back with his arms to his side,
a guy in his mid-50s,
completely unresponsive.
He was laying in water about 3 inches deep, where I guess somebody in the house
had taken the sprayer from the kitchen sink and had sprayed him down,
trying to revive the guy,
bring him back to life. And it doesn't happen that way. So
Jay and Scotty enter the kitchen, stand over this guy.
He hadn't started turning blue yet.
So I checked and make sure he was breathing. And he was.
But barely.
He's taking these really low, shallow breaths.
And then I pulled his eyelids back and checked his pupils.
They're tiny, pinpoint.
So he was overdosed. Pretty indicative of opiates. So I said, okay.
So Jay grabs his medic kit. He goes into his bag and he pulls out this nasal spray. It's a drug called naloxone.
It's also commonly referred to as Narcan. And it's a drug that's known as being this Lazarus drug.
Yeah, because it immediately throws an opioid overdose into reverse and like brings people back from the brink of death.
So Jay crouches over this guy and he takes this nasal spray, sticks it up one of the guy's nostrils, sprays it, takes it out.
Waits a beat. Does the same thing to the other nostril.
Back awake. Within seconds.
The guy opened his eyes.
Talk, what's going on?
I grab a towel and start drying him off.
And then I pushed him up so I could sit him up.
Got him up.
Got him onto the stretcher.
Loaded in the truck. And we take off to St. Clair Hospital.
Scotty's up front. He's driving the ambulance.
Jay's in the back with the patient.
Everything was good with him.
Everything was routine.
When all of a sudden,
Scotty hollered through the window. He yelled at me, "I don't feel right."
I can remember a weird taste coming into my mouth and a real odd smell hitting my nose.
What do you taste?
I can't describe it. It was just, it was like chewing on steel.
Go ahead.
Scotty, while he's driving, he gets on the radio.
Hollering at the next county over, saying, "Hey, I need help.
I've got a light feeling, increased temperature.
I need you to send me an ambulance."
On the eastbound exit ramp of the 137, just have them meet us there, please.
10-4.
Made it to the bottom of the ramp, put the truck in park.
Jay jumped out of the back and ran up to the front.
Went through the passenger side.
Got to Scotty.
He was already slumped over.
Unresponsive.
It was that quick.
Like he was out. Cold.
Huh. Not waking up anything?
No, he's not responding at all.
So what's happening?
Well, this is the thing that, I don't know, was so shocking to me, is that when Jay then checked out Scotty,
he had pinpoint pupils, snoring respirations.
He seemed to have the exact same symptoms as the patient in the back of the ambulance who had overdosed.
Wait, what? The exact same symptoms?
Yeah, that's what it looked like to Jay.
Well, how does that even happen?
Well, so Jay explained it to us like He says if you wind back, they had gone into this apartment to treat this guy who was on the kitchen floor.
The guy was wet.
And he said he believes that when they were helping him up,
Scotty had rubbed against his skin-to-skin contact with his forearm.
And Jay said he believes that what likely happened in that moment is that whatever drug this guy had taken had now gotten onto Scotty's arm, absorbed through his skin into his system, and then like 15 minutes later had caused Scotty to pass out.
Wow. That's really strange.
Yeah, it seems like a really unusual thing to happen. But the thing is, like, I guess what's even weirder is that, like, this wasn't the first time I had heard this story.
Right, like, Peter's been following this for a while.
So, yeah, I've been keeping a list of these types of incidents. And what I found is this wasn't an isolated incident. These types of things are happening a lot.
And now at 6, EMTs in danger.
There have been cases reported in North Carolina, Florida,
where a police officer nearly died.
Rural Ohio, rural Pennsylvania.
From an accidental drug overdose.
West Virginia.
Three police officers in southeast Wisconsin.
Texas.
California.
Rushed to the hospital.
Two EMTs.
Massachusetts.
Taken to the hospital.
All right, breaking news in Providence.
Vermont, New Hampshire.
Two police officers are hospitalized.
Nebraska.
Three EMTs and an officer went to the hospital.
It says a deputy went to the hospital overnight.
The officer was responding to an overdose.
There's been over 100 reported incidents all over the country. So, I mean, I've been reporting on opioids for a number of years, and I guess as I was watching these kinds of incidents occur, it kind of felt like I was watching a contagion like unfold in real time.
Hmm.
I mean, I guess when I was reading all these stories, I was just thinking, like, what is going on here? Like, what's happening?
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. And today we have a story about what happened that day in that apartment, in that ambulance in Kentucky. Definitely kind of a mystery story.
But at its core, it's really a story about wanting to do good, choosing to do good, and then having to suddenly bear the cost of doing good.
Okay. The story comes to us from Peter Smith, freelance journalist, and it also was co-reported by
Peter,
our producer, Matt Kilty.
Hey, everybody.
Okay, so
Kentucky.
Kentucky.
So we wanted to talk to Scotty and his partner, Jay, about what happened that day.
And about what's been happening.
So we flew into Lexington. We drove about an hour east.
And it was some nice rolling bluegrass hills.
Yeah, a lot of green. And we drove to this tiny little city called Owingsville. And we're at the Bath County Emergency Medical Services.
Where the Bath County EMS is.
White building. Linoleum siding. Big garage doors like you'd see at like an auto shop. A couple big white Bath County EMS ambulances. It's funny, there's a washer dryer, ashtray on top of it. And attached to the garage is a one-story house, basically.
So we essentially just showed up at this place to introduce ourselves and say, hey.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you.
There were a few people inside.
Gary, the director of the station, was there.
Yeah.
And you're serving the whole county?
Yeah, I think it's 284 square miles, I think, is how big our county is.
You know about how many people that is?
A little over 12,000 now, I believe. And we're covering that out of one station.
Feels like there's beds in back?
Yeah, beds in the back, yeah.
You all end up just kind of like living here?
Yeah, it's basically like an apartment.
There's a kitchen. We were in the living room with Gary sitting on a couch. There's these big lazy boys, a ginormous TV. Billy Bob Thornton was on.
He's a mean dude.
In the show?
No, he's just a mean dude in real life. Remember that? We went to a Willie Nelson concert, and his band opened for Willie Nelson, and somebody in the audience heckled him. And he just about came off the stage after him, and he called him everything but a sewing machine and a milk cow. He made up cuss words. Yeah, he's a wiry little feller.
So we were kind of just hanging around with Gary.
It was probably like 15 minutes, and then...
There's Scotty.
Scotty walked in.
That's Peter Smith.
Nice to meet you.
Matt Kilty.
How you guys doing?
This is the EMT who overdosed?
Yeah, Scotty's the guy that supposedly overdosed.
He's in his 50s, white hair, tall.
Got bright blue eyes.
I got a question. How did you even find out about all this?
I read in the New York Times. There was one line in the story about three EMS personnel. I don't know if that's the true story.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Picked up on the story.
Yeah. And so then I thought there was something unusual about that, and I was curious to hear the real story.
Yeah, give me just a few minutes and
Yeah, no rush.
And there's no rush. Sit down and then discuss things.
All right.
So eventually it was just the three of us in this living room.
You want to set at the table or?
Maybe I should preface this by saying that you can't really understand this story unless you understand a little bit about what EMS personnel do. I talked to some other EMTs that told me that everybody has their why. Everybody has this thing they say. It's like, this is the reason I got into this line of business. I would say like a very small percentage, like don't have second or third jobs. Like they don't make a lot of money. So everybody has this why.
Yeah, maybe you can just like tell. I think.
And so I asked Scotty what his why was. And he told me this story. And I think it's a really incredible story that not only explains why he does what he does, but it also explained like why he holds on to certain things.
So in September of 1999, I was involved in an accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
So it was early in the morning. It was raining.
Yeah, it was during Hurricane Floyd.
He was out there for work?
Cross-country trucking.
What kind of rig were you driving?
It was a Freightliner, and I was pulling a flatbed trailer with a load of pipe on it.
So he's barreling down the turnpike with this heavy load of steel on the back. And with the weather, like, visibility starts to get bad.
Slowed my speed way down, probably running approximately 50, 55 mile an hour.
And he comes through this construction site.
And something happened in the front end of the truck.
You heard a pop.
A front tire had blown out, and I basically became a passenger at that point. There was no control in it.
His 18-wheeler was, like, careening out of control down the turnpike, and it is like skidding across the wet pavement.
And the truck lunged to the right.
There was a concrete wall there that had guardrail attached to it. It nosed into the guardrail.
Came flying back across both lanes.
Back toward the center divider, and the truck hit it.
Plowed through the center divider.
And began to like roll over.
And came down and struck a vehicle that was traveling the other direction.
Scotty says he doesn't remember much of what happened next, other than his truck finally coming to a stop.
After that, the next thing I remember was standing on the frame of the truck, watching diesel fuel run underneath of me, and I could hear the truck burning.
Somehow he managed to get out of the cab, and he's standing on this tail of the cab, and the truck is on fire. And like while he's standing there, like other people who were driving down the highway have stopped and they've started to like yell at him.
Screaming at me to get away from the truck. I got off the truck and I looked up the road and I saw the other vehicle and I knew then that it wasn't good.
What did it look like?
It was a very destroyed vehicle.
So what happens next?
There was a lady had a minivan. I have no idea where she came from. She opened the side door on her minivan and had me sit in the floorboard until the ambulance got there. I remember looking down at my left hand and the back of my left hand, all the skin was probably hanging down 8 to 10, 12 inches where it had melted the skin. And
like your skin's just dangling off your body?
Yeah. I can remember when the ambulance getting there and there was a female paramedic. And when she walked up and looked at me, I remember her going, "Oh my God." And I went, "This ain't good, is it?" And she said, "No." She didn't lie to me. She said, "No, it's not good."
He got rushed to a hospital. He had 5 broken ribs, massive skin burns.
I do remember him telling me, "You're going to lose your left hand." And I told him, I said, "That's not an option. I'm left-handed."
Surgeons immediately started doing skin grafts.
Took skin off my legs and put on my arms and my back. As you can see, I've still got my left hand.
Still left-handed?
I'm still left-handed.
And when you said it was a couple days after the accident when they told you about the other car?
Yeah.
How did that conversation unfold?
It was an attorney that was for the representing the trucking company that I was driving for, was the one that actually told me about the fatalities that had been involved with the accident. So that was how I found out.
Do you remember what exactly happened?
I can just remember him walking into the hospital room and he's like, hi, my name is, yeah, and my name's so-and-so, and I'm an attorney with representing the company that you drive for, and we don't know if you've been informed of this or not, but there was three fatalities involved, and no, I hadn't been informed, but guess I have been now. When we started into court proceedings, that was when I found out names and where they were from.
Where were they from?
They were from Connecticut. They had been on vacation in North Carolina. The hurricane coming in, they were evacuated out of North Carolina. So they had decided that they were going to travel up into Pennsylvania and try to find a place to finish their vacation in Pennsylvania. And that's what put them there. If I'd have traveled two miles an hour faster or 2 miles an hour slower, we wouldn't have been at the same place at the same time.
Scotty eventually went back to long-haul trucking, but he says that he kept thinking about that day, about that accident, the people who were killed.
Never forgot. Still haven't forgotten.
But the other thing that really struck him about that day was that everybody who showed up to that scene, the fire department, the EMS.
Everybody there was volunteer.
And that's something he couldn't really shake.
That people volunteered to come to me and they didn't know who I was. They didn't care who I was. They didn't pass judgment on me that, yeah, I was in a horrific accident and I may have been the cause of that accident. They didn't care. They viewed me as someone that needed help. And that was all they viewed me as.
And Scotty said the more he thought about it, the more he felt like he had this sort of debt to pay back for the lives that were lost that day.
For the ones that he extinguished. And the way that he's going to do that is become a volunteer. He's going to become one of these people.
Who help those in need.
That comes to your aid, no matter what.
And as they say, you know, the rest is history. Here I am. I'm an EMT.
So we spent a few days with Scotty following him around on some of his runs. And as an EMT, his main responsibility is to drive the ambulance, but also to assist his partner.
Hello.
Hi. Who's often Jay.
What's going on?
And out in rural Kentucky, they get all sorts of calls.
Hey, come here, honey. They just want to look at you. It's okay. You're okay.
How long has he been acting like that, huh?
Since last night.
Okay.
Like a three-year-old who was having trouble breathing.
Just breathe. It's look at my mom. It's okay.
You want to go for a ride, ma'am?
Mommy, go.
A lot of calls from nursing homes.
Deep breath. Does that hurt?
Got him on 6 on Main.
Where a call can be for something that feels like so small, like a cough or low blood sugar.
Ready to go.
Portable over to Main.
One night, 9:20 at night, got a call. Older woman fell off the porch. They helped pick up an elderly woman.
Oh, good job. Good job.
Sometimes they just get called to give people their meds.
You're going to feel a big poke, okay? Count of three. Here we go. 1, 2, 3. Big poke.
These are like kind of like the everyday innocuous calls. And then, of course, like, there are overdoses.
By the way, I'm Matt.
I'm Earl.
Earl.
Nice to meet you.
Peter.
I'm Earl.
Because we were, like, these out-of-town reporters, everybody kept saying that we should go down to the old jail.
So you're the jailer?
Yeah.
Which is where we met the county jailer, Earl.
How's it going, sir?
How you doing there, bud?
I'm Matt.
And his friend, Mitchell.
Nice to meet you.
Alrighty.
And so... So Earl led us into the jail. It's abandoned now.
Paint peeling off the walls.
He walked us into this front room.
Let's see, how much dice do you more than you got?
It's full of weed whackers, lawnmowers.
Earl oversees the work release program, so the people that are in jail are sort of on this temporary work release program where they, like, do lawn maintenance along the highway.
Oh, I'll sit down. Where have they got them at? Oh, it's over there. I see it.
Yeah.
Well, we're in the corner.
And then Earl grabbed this red bucket, which he set down. It's like a knee-high bucket.
Mine's pretty nasty.
Oh, my God.
That's from this year. But you can see, that's just this year.
That's so many syringes. How many do you think you got in there?
I'd say there's 1,000, wouldn't you, Mitch?
Close anyway.
Yeah, close to it. That was like all last year. Yeah. All last year.
People on work release have been picking these up for like the past year.
These are just litter on the highway.
Yeah.
It's been awful. They used to have the kids, you know, would clean up like Boy Scouts and stuff, clean up long roads. But it just got too bad with the needles now. You just can't do it anymore with the way the needles and stuff are.
Mm-mm. Yeah, it's all kinds of myrrh in that big bottle, ain't
it? I forgot
about the NBA. Yeah, or it'd be
another bottle full. There's probably 20-30 in there.
Yeah.
Here's another one. Mm. We got a problem here. There's no doubt about that. There's definitely a problem with heroin use.
Someone's got it in it. Still got the stuff in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I still got the drugs in there?
Blood, too.
Yeah.
Huh.
That first year, we really found them, didn't we?
They threw a bunch of them away, too, before we started saving them.
Yeah.
Did it surprise you to find this many?
Really, yeah.
Well, it just all... The heroin problem just started just like overnight here. I mean, it was pills forever, and then just all at once... I mean, nobody even ever seen a needle, did you, Mitchell?
No.
And then just all at once, they were everywhere.
When did you start seeing them?
About a year ago.
It's been longer than that. Yeah, it's been about two and a half years ago. And it just,
nothing like this.
And once it started, you started finding them, they were everywhere then.
And so what do you think when you see all these needles?
I just think it's a bad thing. It's destroying families, and we have somebody dying here just all the time. I mean, it's really bad. Sad. I had a very good friend that I lost. What was it, Mitchell, back last August? Yeah.
Somewhere along there.
I had took him to rehab, and he was in there for a couple months, and he got out and done good, and then that happened to him.
And that was sort of the incredible thing.
There's something for everyone here, so have your pick.
All right, well, I'll take a look around.
Okay.
Was that, like, everybody knew somebody who had been caught up in using opioids?
I mean, nice families, somebody in their family end up on them bad.
Like, I went to a yard sale because I love yard sales, and...
Every family is affected some way.
When I told the women who were sitting there on the driveway what we were reporting on, they said they had lost neighbors, friends.
Well, let's put it like this. In 2000...
You know, one day when we were down there, we had to take a lift.
No, in 1990, I had a motorcycle accident, which destroyed my left femur. I've got a 12-inch plate, 10 screws, and 2 pins that hold my left femur together.
And the driver told us how he'd started using pills?
And really came by quite innocently.
I talked to a woman who worked at a thrift store who told me she lost a cousin to an overdose. Actually, Jay told us about a friend of his.
He actually relapsed. He was in therapy. His sponsor in Narcotics Anonymous overdosed. And he had nobody to go to, so he relapsed and was found 2 days later in his car. So it was pretty bad.
And I would assume that the MS, Scotty and Jay, would have seen this shift happen.
Yeah, Scotty told us around 2017, overdose calls.
Went from 1 or 2 a week to...
5, 6, one day.
There was 11. And that was just unheard of in this county, to have that many overdoses.
They told us they would treat the same person like 5 times over a few months. Like, this is just their job.
Right, they're there to save people's lives.
But... this overdose problem and the sort of like moral calculus that any EMS person makes when they show up to help a person who is OD'd, it started to shift when reports started emerging about this new drug. This drug that made it so simply coming into contact with a person, like just simply touching them, could put an EMS worker in danger.
Wasn't a lot known about it.
We talked to this guy, Jason York, about it.
He's the emergency management director for the county.
When it first came out, the reports that we were getting was literally airborne.
Have you ever seen it?
No.
What do you think, like, just hearing about it? I mean, what's going through your mind when you hear about it?
World War Z. Walking Dead.
The drug is called fentanyl.
What is fentanyl? Like, I know that it's an opioid, But is it like...
So fentanyl...
Didn't you talk to a guy about this a while back?
I did. I talked to this guy, John Cole.
Okay.
Can you tell me again, like, who you are and...
Yeah. I'm an emergency physician here at Hennepin County Medical Center, which is a level one trauma center in Minneapolis.
He's also the director of the Minnesota Poison Control.
So fentanyl has been around for decades, and we use it almost every day in my hospital in some capacity.
So fentanyl is an opioid. It's fully synthetic. It's manufactured in the laboratory. And it often comes in powder form, but drug companies reformulated it into all sorts of things, like fentanyl lollipops. Hmm. And these lollipops are given to soldiers on the battlefield. There's also fentanyl patches.
That people wear to get fentanyl into their body through their skin.
Oh, so you can do fentanyl through the skin.
Yeah.
It's an easy way to put something on for people with really bad chronic pain. People with cancer, for instance, use them.
It's just this really, really effective painkiller.
Because fentanyl is really, really potent.
I mean, a lot of people refer to fentanyl as sort of the third wave of the opioid crisis.
Just for context, I mean, what are the first two waves?
Yeah. If you don't mind. Well, so if you go back to the beginning of the crisis, the first wave was pills.
Right.
When in the early 2000s, drug manufacturers began flooding communities with pharmaceutical grade opioids.
Okay.
And the second wave was around 2011 when there was a crackdown on pills. And so a lot of people that were using pharmaceuticals began to migrate to heroin. And the Mexican cartels got very good at delivering that heroin. And then around 2013,
opioid crisis, overdose.
The third wave hits.
America's worst drug crisis ever.
Drug dealers, people that were selling heroin, start looking to fentanyl.
Because fentanyl is so much cheaper to either make or obtain than normal heroin.
And most importantly, fentanyl is way more potent. And so basically, to maximize their profit, drug dealers start cutting fentanyl into heroin. The problem is that the people who are using, they really have no idea what they're getting. They think they're just getting heroin.
And certainly by 2014, we started to see patients in our emergency department who were overdosed with what they thought was heroin that probably turned out to be fentanyl.
And as more and more people were overdosing,
fentanyl,
dying,
a powerful synthetic opioid,
there were all these news stories about
a powerful opioid,
this
fentanyl,
powerful, ultra-potent synthetic opioid.
30 to 50 times as powerful as heroin itself.
And there are versions of it where, you know, the molecules changed a little bit and it makes it more potent.
And by 2016,
an even more dangerous drug is now hitting the street.
It's called carfentanil.
It's a new synthetic opioid usually used to tranquilize elephants.
Now, this deadly drug is popping up in our backyards.
And carfentanil is extremely potent.
The same size as just 7 grains of salt could kill you.
John says it was right around this time, 2016.
There started to be reports of...
I fall backwards.
Law enforcement.
And I'm trying to hold on to anything I can grasp.
Emergency medical services.
My face started burning.
And even nurses in hospitals.
Like I broke out in a sweat.
Describing getting ill when they were exposed to powder that turned out later to be fentanyl or some other type of fentanyl.
How did you first hear about it?
How did I hear about it? You guys, the media.
Oh, yeah, I forget I'm a representative of the media.
Scotty said he actually first heard about carfentanil in Good Morning America.
Started reading articles on it.
Jay saw other people in EMS tweeting about it.
You know, what is this drug? What is going on?
But that's in the big city. It's not going to happen here.
And then one of our local law enforcement officers, Bud Lyons.
So you read about... fentanyl.
I mean, I've read about it, but I didn't think it would come to a small city like this.
So that's Bud Lyons.
He's a police officer. He's a canine officer here.
So what happened?
Basically, I was dispatched to the funeral home.
So it was the summer of 2017. Bud got called out to the parking lot of the funeral home.
A female had passed out.
In her car.
When I got on scene, woke her up, got her out of the vehicle. She noticed that she had some brown stuff on her face, like a powder substance around her nostrils.
He searched the car and took into evidence $1,000 in cash.
And several little baggies of brown powder substance that turned out to be heroin.
And that same night, as he was like back in the evidence room going through the money.
I didn't have no gloves on when I was counting the money.
Started feeling funny.
Started feeling real dizzy. Couldn't think straight.
Dropped the money.
And drove his cruiser up here into the parking lot.
Of the EMS station.
And when he pulled in, he went down.
A couple of EMS were there, gave him this this Lazarus drug, Narcan.
Rushed me to the hospital.
Had that ever happened to you before?
No, it's the first time it's ever happened. And, you know, just that little touch basically almost killed me.
Just a grain of fentanyl got on his skin and he's saying that's all it took?
Yeah, like that was the story that was starting to emerge really across the country, that like a tiny grain, if you came into contact with a tiny grain of this drug, it could take you down.
So as soon as that happened, Scotty, we made it a pact between us to carry extra Narcan in the truck for us in case we ever got exposed, because I knew it was here in the county and in the city. And then about a month after that, sure enough,
chewing on steel, put the truck in park.
My partner got exposed.
I can remember coming to and being in another ambulance.
Jay had given Scotty their Narcan they had stashed away.
His dose of Narcan and mine, because he wouldn't wake up after the first dose.
They got him to the hospital.
Scotty was kept under evaluation for about 4 hours.
And then eventually discharged.
The next day, it was like, that was when it hit on the fact of, you know what? I almost died doing my job.
And that's essentially when what began as a call for help became a crime scene.
What do you mean?
I will tell you in a minute, after the break.
Chad.
Robert.
Radiolab.
Back to Peter and Matt.
In Kentucky.
Starts right now at Cartown King.
Let's get on.
He was on the show years back.
Freedom from fear and all of its
time. Something that I kept thinking about when we were down there in Kentucky driving around was that there is like no duty to render aid. Even though there are some exceptions and statutes in some states, like for the most part, there's just no obligation. We live in a society where you like do not, you can sort of watch a person drown and you won't be held liable. You can do that. And that's legal. I just kept thinking about that.
Of Eastern Kentucky, or
we've mostly just been here.
Oh, is that right?
So when we were down there with Earl the jailer.
Yeah, in the jail, the old Bath County jail.
We had just seen the needles and we were coming out to the parking lot.
So I go to Wisconsin.
And we had spent probably like 2 or 3 days trying to find the people who were actually in the apartment, like the person who overdosed and the other two people who we learned lived in that apartment.
I had a phone number, but nobody was picking up. But we're with Earl. And I just asked him if he knew this guy, Scotty Hatton.
Scotty White.
This is a different Scotty.
This is a different Scotty.
Right, because Scotty Whiteman's the EMT who responded to the call, had this seemingly like overdose exposure. Scotty Hatton lived in the apartment.
Yeah, he was there the day that Scotty and Jay showed up.
Yeah, I know him.
Uh-huh.
What, do y'all want to talk to him or?
Yeah, we got the Scotty Whiteman started the story and we're just curious if...
What do you want to talk to him about? What went on that night or...
Just get his side of the story. I know that.
I don't think that he could right now because his case ain't final.
Uh-huh.
Sure. I just about guarantee you won't.
But then he was like, I can tell you where he is though, because it turns out that Scotty Hatton had on an ankle monitor and Earl, you know, he's the jailer, so he just like pulls up his phone and looks up Scotty's GPS location.
Yeah, and so the little dot for the GPS showed exactly where he was at this old cemetery.
That graveyard's what, Mitchell?
And Earl said like we could go down there and like maybe he would talk to us. So we get there, pretty big and sprawling cemetery that was like 25 minutes out of town. Something like that?
Yeah, lots of big trees, cicadas.
Anyway, Scotty was actually out on this riding lawnmower, and we were standing there talking to his supervisor.
Right.
And then Scotty himself, like, gets off the lawnmower, comes over to us.
What did he look like?
Sunken eyes, Big eyes.
Pretty skinny guy.
He's wearing like a blue Duke ball cap.
Blue jeans.
So Scotty came over. His supervisor just went on the lawnmower and started riding around. And Scotty immediately started talking.
It seemed like he wanted to tell his side of the story.
He said he got sick. I'm looking online. It's like sometimes it can take 24 hours.
And he was standing under this big oak tree, kind of like on a steep slope.
Sorry, mine. You mind, I missed the back or the front of that. You're saying that you think it's doubtful?
I think it's very doubtful.
And he immediately started telling us that he was like suspicious of Scotty Whiteman's story, this whole like overdose by touch thing.
I mean, because he only touched my other co-defendant, you know, and I had washed him off. You know, I didn't know you're not supposed to wash someone that's overdosing off, but I did. And this guy's trying to say he got infected, you know, got affected by car fentanyl, and they didn't even find any drugs on the scene. They found very little paraphernalia, but I know I'm done. It's just one of those things. I'm going to church now. As soon as I get this ankle monitor off, I'm going to get saved. I can't get saved, and with the ankle monitor, you can't submerge it.
Where are you going to get baptized?
I go to Freedom Church in Mount Sterling. Probably going to ask them. Being in front of a bunch of people make me kind of nervous.
We decided to meet up with him later because of the lawnmower, cicadas. So we went to his aunt's house.
He was living there. He'd gotten evicted from his apartment after the OD.
Well, I'm going.
Love you too. You're going to see Ruby, ain't you?
Yeah. It's nice to meet you guys.
Nice to meet you too.
Thanks again.
Our lady's in there. She, I don't know if she really wants to participate, so.
Jessica's in here, you're saying?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So apparently Scotty's girlfriend, Jessica, she was the other person in the apartment for this overdose. She was also now living with Scotty at his aunt's, but she didn't want to talk to us.
So then the three of us sat down on the couch in the living room, and Scotty just started telling us about his own story. And I think his story definitely is a very, like, sort of common trajectory.
Where did you grow up? Was it around here?
Yeah, I grew up in Bath County. I've been here my whole life, pretty much.
So Scotty grew up in government housing in a small apartment with his sister, his mom.
She had another husband by then. Not my dad. He's my stepdad.
His stepdad is this guy named Ricky,
who figures pretty prominently in this story.
He drank a lot. Wasn't all that good at home. Then I was like 15, 16. I moved in with my grandma and lived with my dad and my grandma. And I was into sports. I made decent grades. Now I don't even hardly go see my dad. He caught him a case, I guess. He's got several charges pending.
So when was the first time you used?
First time I ever took narcotics, I was 19.
According to Scotty, what happened was he got kidney stones.
Never had a pain worse than that. Hurt so bad I was crying.
He mentioned it to his dad.
He had a motorcycle wreck, kind of messed him up. You know, he just, you know, said, here, you know, you can take one of my pain pills.
It was a Lortab, which is hydrocodone and acetaminophen.
Yeah, he said when he took it,
euphoria.
Felt just total relief.
But I just liked the feeling, you know. Makes you feel really, really good.
Not long after that,
getting his medicine, I ain't gonna lie, and I'd take it. You know, take two or three. And then it just, you know, got to experimenting more and more.
Started using Perc 30s, which are definitely flooding into places like Kentucky in the early 2000s. So this is like the sort of first wave of the opioid crisis.
So Scotty said at first he would get pills from friends, people at work.
And then it just, you know, got to, well, you know, I started buying pills. And
when do you feel like it crossed over from?
Probably my mid-20s.
He started taking Oxycontin, and he said he was working at the time stocking bread.
Right, he was stocking bread. He was also working in a factory.
Because I'd be like, well, I'd rather work because I'd steal off somebody. And I've always been that way. I don't really want to steal off people.
So you're like, I can work and make enough money to...
It was really hard. I mean, I made $500-$600 a week, and, you know, I wouldn't have any left.
Because he had spent all of it on pills.
And he was doing that for years, and probably it was about like 2011 or 12.
You know, heroin came around. That's when I started doing it.
Because it was cheaper?
Because it was cheaper. Because I was spending $80 to $100 on two pills.
$80 to $100 for just two pills?
Just two pills. And, you know, you might get a little bit high, and it might not last very long at all. And, you know, for $80 or $100 of heroin, you can get a lot more, and it's a lot more powerful. So that it just made sense.
Scotty told us he did heroin for like 5 or 6 years. He didn't inject it, but he would snort it. And he says he tried to quit a couple of times, but just
didn't, which was probably just an excuse for I couldn't. I had to hit rock, complete rock bottom.
And for Scotty, he says that was the day of the overdoses in that apartment.
Yeah.
Can you pick up at some point? Like where does it start?
You're probably going to have to ask me like questions on this, because I'm going to may shy back from some of it a little bit. So ask me again what you want.
Yeah. So you're living down there with Jessica and your son, Gabriel.
So Jessica, Scotty's girlfriend, the two of them have a son together, Gabriel.
Mm-hmm. And it's her apartment. Mm-hmm. And at some point, Ricky is with you guys.
Again, Ricky is his stepdad.
They're like, why is he over there that day?
Well, I mean, he's burned all his bridges.
From what we learned, it sounds like he was last living with friends and like they had a falling out.
Yeah, it seemed like everybody else had sort of given up on him.
We felt sorry for him. He didn't have nowhere to go. So, you know, you can stay here a couple days. I mean, that was it.
And then, like, I don't know, where would you start with that day?
Really don't know where to go with this.
It's fine.
I'm trying to not, you know,
right.
Say it right now.
I think last time we spoke, it was like at some point you noticed Ricky.
I can go from there probably a little bit. You know, I was
in the room. Scotty explained to us that he and Jessica were in the living room of the apartment sitting on the couch, and that at some point Ricky had gotten up and gone into the kitchen. And after a little while, Scotty realized that the kitchen sink, the water in the kitchen sink had been running for a while.
And I'm like, why is the water running? You know, so I go in there.
Goes into the kitchen and sees Ricky standing over the kitchen sink. And he said he looked
locked up.
Frozen.
Like his arms were really stiff. His fists were sort of like clenched.
Bracing.
Grabbing the countertop.
With his tongue flopping back and forth in his mouth. You can kind of, his mouth barely open. You can see it. I kind of knew what it probably was.
He's ODing.
I get a chair and I get him. I struggle to get him in it. I get him in the chair and he's out. We have one of those, not only a faucet, we got one of those spray things. I was spraying him.
Sprays for the dishes.
Yeah. I was spraying him with cold water. I was thinking, well, you know, it might wake him up. I'm washing him in the face, and I did smack him in the face a few times. He wouldn't wake up. So then I knew we had to make the decision to call the ambulance service.
What happens next?
I started getting a little bit, you know, out of it, I guess. I don't remember a lot after that.
So I've listened to the 911 call, and Scotty didn't really tell us this, and I don't know. I mean, it's not that I don't believe him, but I do think that there was something. I do think that they sort of, like, in that moment, they must have been a little like, what do we do next?
Tuesday, August 8, 2017.
Because the thing is, they weren't the first ones to call 911 that day.
Beth K911.
The first person to call was actually Ricky's brother.
Yeah, this is Ronnie from Salt Lake. I just got a phone call. My brother has OD'd at Bernard Heights.
Which means someone must have called Ricky's brother, told him what was going on. They didn't know what to do.
Because when he calls, he says something like,
they're scared to call because they don't think somebody's got warrants and shit on them up there and they're going to let him there and die. Who's your
brother? Something about outstanding warrants, or like they're worried about outstanding warrants.
Yeah, they're trying to throw him in a car and shit.
Don't know the apartment number?
No, sir, they won't tell me.
Okay, I'll try. I'll give you an answer so they can find it.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Bye. You go.
And then another thing you hear in these recordings,
K911,
is this other call.
I'm over there.
Which is from one of Scotty and Jessica's neighbors.
One of my neighbors came over a few minutes ago, and
I think she's talking about Scotty, is that Scotty had come over to her house.
And he told me that his stepdad was currently overdosing in his apartment, and that they were scared to call the ambulance.
She made him leave.
Because he was severely intoxicated on drugs.
And from reading the reports, sounds like their one-year-old son was in the apartment at the time.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, their one-year-old Gabriel.
I think they were worried about the police coming and losing custody of their kid.
Mm.
And so like for them, in that moment, when Ricky was lying on the floor, I think there were some questions in their mind, like, what's the right thing to do? And how do we do the right thing without getting ourselves in trouble?
But
back on dispatch.
They did make the call.
yes, I need an ambulance to Bernard Heights, apartment 301.
Jessica calls 911.
It was 2 minutes after Ricky's brother made that first call.
Okay, what's going on? Is this overdose?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay.
And I believe one of the reasons that they made the call that day was because they knew about this law.
I didn't know exactly what it said. I did know that it came in my mind, yeah, we'll be okay.
A law that was designed to protect people in exactly this situation.
The Good Samaritan Law.
It's called the Good Samaritan Law.
It's developed because we want to protect people who care about other people.
So around 2010, 2011, 12, as this opioid epidemic was escalating,
House File 238, the Good Samaritan Bill,
a lot of states started adopting these 911 Good Samaritan laws.
46 states, including Kentucky, now have these laws.
Which essentially say if you're using drugs with someone and that person overdoses,
we don't want you fearful that if you make the call that may save their life, that you'll be in trouble.
Like when the police show up, you and the person who overdosed won't be charged. You're granted immunity because you essentially did the right thing. Like you reached out for help.
The sort of like intent of the Good Samaritan Law is to make people who are in the presence of a drug overdose, you want these people to call for help because otherwise, you know, there's a greater risk that these people are just going to die.
Hmm. Where does the Good Samaritan, I mean, it is a Christian parable, right?
We got the Bible right here. So, yeah, it's a parable in the Gospel of Luke. So it's Jesus is telling the story, and so there's a Jew. He's on the road to Jericho, and as he's walking along, some robbers come and they steal his money and they beat him up and they leave him in a ditch and they've essentially left him for dead. And then another person comes along the road, but instead of helping him, this person crosses the road and like just keeps on walking. Second person comes by, same thing. And then a third person comes and it's a Samaritan. And like the Jews and the Samaritans were like mortal enemies. Like they absolutely detested each other. But when the Samaritan sees this Jew lying in a ditch in need, the Good Samaritan stops and he helps this guy and gives him money and shelter and treats his wounds and, you know, like essentially saves his life. So it's a story about like
showing kindness to your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Or your enemy showing kindness to you.
Right.
I guess the other thing that's interesting about this is that Jesus is talking to a legal scholar. And so it's sort of about setting up like morality versus the law. And so, like, I guess what he's saying is that if you see somebody that's in need, you don't think about what the law says you should or shouldn't do. You just help the person in need. It's like, you know, unconditional love, like, takes precedent over the letter of the law.
Like, but then, of course, there is the law.
Ronnie, those New York reporters are here to stick a microphone in your face.
And what seems to be happening across the country is prosecutors are beginning to push back against the Good Samaritan.
Come on in, guys.
Thank you.
So we talked to this guy, Ronnie Goldie. He's the Commonwealth attorney. And he's also the lead prosecutor in the case against Ricky, Jessica, and Scotty.
It's kind of weird that you guys got this from
out of New York, and it's just not something that I would have expected, certainly, because, you know, we're used to our own little problems down here, and I would assume you've got bigger problems in New York to deal with than what we were dealing with, but that's fine. I mean, I'm glad that you guys got down this way.
So what did he say to you about the case?
As Ronnie sort of explained it to us,
you go back with our legislature and the way they have drafted the Good Samaritan Law.
The way the law is written in Kentucky is that if you call 911 for a drug overdose, you're only granted immunity for two specific types of charges.
You cannot charge them with possession of controlled substance.
Drug possession.
Or possession of drug paraphernalia.
Drug paraphernalia.
Just those two charges. Well, we didn't charge them with possession. We charged them with one endangerment.
And this is where you see this sort of pushback. One endangerment, that's a legal term for when you do something that puts somebody at risk for physical injury or death.
It's a conscious disregard for what could occur.
It's like driving drunk.
So in this situation,
so by having the drugs everywhere that were laced with fentanyl, you created a risk, number one, of the child being seriously injured or killed based on an overdose or other injuries. And then also you placed paramedics, law enforcement, and social workers that would have to come in under that circumstance.
So rather than granting Scotty, Ricky, and Jessica protection, Ronnie Goldie, Commonwealth of Kentucky, has charged them with 10 counts of felony wanton endangerment. So each one of them are getting hit with 10 felony charges.
Whoa. Why 10?
So there was one charge for endangering the child. So like the 1-year-old could have gotten into the drug somehow and become exposed that way. And then there was nine additional charges, one for each of the people that came to the house that day, the police, the social workers, and all the EMS that responded.
And I think we should say here that Jessica, who's now facing these 10 felony charges, the day of the overdose, she actually tested negative for opiates.
Right. And their kid checked out okay, too.
But I think she's now facing these charges because essentially she made that call. She was like in the apartment and made the call. The other thing to mention is that like the thing that she and Scotty were scared of, which was losing custody of their son, that did happen.
I'm not mad about that. I understand that. I understand that aspect, you know. Drug stuff found in the home, you know, they took him. I understand that. As far as the other things, 10 felonies, I don't understand them.
But Ronnie's argument is that because of the number of people who had been overdosing in the community, because of the local and national news reporting about heroin being laced with drugs like fentanyl and carfentanil, that you can argue
that's a risk that you knew was out there, but yet you're using anyway. You should know better.
So it feels like, I don't know if loophole is the right word, but it's like it's a way in which you can still, as you've said, like you're precluded from bringing charges for possession of drugs and paraphernalia. But like there is this sort of side door to be like, well, we can charge you for this.
No, that's not the case at all. It's not like we're trying to say, OK, we don't like the Good Samaritan law. Let's go around it. That's not how I work. That's not how we work.
This is the thing I don't really understand. It seems like the net effect of the Good Samaritan law is to sort of reduce fatalities. And it seems like the data I've seen is like it's rather successful in reducing fatalities. So you are, by encouraging people to call 911, you are reducing fatalities. And in this case, if they hadn't called 911, it's possible that the Ricky Mays, the patient, would have died. So in some ways, I feel like...
Sure, I get it. I totally understand it. I totally understand the reason behind it. But what I may think morally or personally, I don't have that luxury. I have a statute that I have to follow because when I took the oath of office, it is that I will uphold the laws of the Commonwealth. And if it's a crime, it's a crime. I don't get to say, well, but they were trying to do the right thing. If it's a crime, it is a crime, and I have to pursue it.
We talked to another prosecutor involved in this case.
Okay.
Kim Hunt Price. She's the county attorney who indicted Ricky, Scotty, and Jessica.
You know, you have people whose jobs are to protect the public who have to be there. You know, the message needs to go out there. These people are protected as well.
But there wasn't, like, pressure. People weren't calling you locally, or there wasn't somebody from, like, the state?
No. There was no, like, no one calling from the state or anything like that. I mean, I just had my local people, you know, that were concerned about it. And
was it the people who were there were calling you, or like who?
I kind of think one of them did call me, you know, and just say, is there anything we can do, you know, with regard to this? Is there an appropriate criminal charge?
Do you remember who that was off the top of your head?
Believe Mr. Whiteman is who did.
Okay, so
when we talked to Scotty Whiteman, we asked him essentially why was it that he wanted to see these people charged.
I view it as a call for accountability. If they're doing heroin, we'll get out here and we'll roll around in the yard for a week. I have no issues with that. But when you do something that could cause harm to me, I've got a problem with that.
I think, like, I understand that, but ultimately also feel like that they truly didn't know that, like, this is a drug that somebody could, like, brush up against or something like that and potentially have a reaction, that there's just not enough knowledge there for them to have even a sense of the fact that they could be endangering other people. And then so to know that you had been through this experience with this accident, I always kind of felt like, oh, I'm just surprised that you wouldn't maybe extend to them a sort of, like, I don't know if sympathy is the right word, but
I think that if you harm someone, you should be held accountable. You guys know now that I'm going on vacation. September the 16th is a hard day.
That's the anniversary of his truck accident where he killed three people.
Is that Sunday?
Yes, because, yep.
Yeah, it's Sunday.
So Sunday I will probably lock myself in a room away from everybody for the biggest part of the morning. If I'm scheduled to work on September the 16th, it's a day that I take off. From the morning till noon is time for me to pay my respects to them. And even though here we are coming up on 19 years later, I still do that. And it's just my way of dealing with it, I guess.
What do you do in that moment when you isolate yourself?
It's one of those that I reflect on that morning, and I still try to figure out if there was anything that I could have done different that may have changed the outcome. What could I done, me personally? Well, I still have nightmares. I still wake up in cold sweats.
I'm curious. You mentioned this last time we were here. So initially, I think there was a lawsuit filed by the family against the company, but then there was a civil suit that you had to go through. That you said eventually bankrupted you. And what I'm wondering is, did you feel that was deserved? Do you feel like that was justified?
Yes. Yes. I took three members of that family away from them. That took potential earnings away from that family. Birthdays and Christmases missed with those that were taken that day. So, yeah, I feel that we're very justified. I was held accountable for my actions of that morning. And then when you look at the exposure case, he needs to be accountable for those actions because he knew the risks that were involved.
Right, just as I think getting behind the wheel of a truck on September 16th, 1999, there could be consequences, but you never, that's why it's an accident, right? It's the same thing. If he had taken two milligrams less of the drug, those seem like really similar situations almost. And I guess I'm just wondering why is it hard to forgive him for that?
I didn't say I didn't forgive him for it. It's just, I think he needs to be held accountable for his actions.
I mean, all of that sort of brings us to the big question in the story. What happened that day? Because if we're going to hold Scotty Hatton accountable for what happened to Scotty Whiteman, you need to be able to show that the drugs in the apartment or whatever was on Ricky's skin could actually cause him to overdose.
Do you have any reason to doubt that?
Well, the reason I found this story was it was reported as a credible report in the New York Times. Everybody sort of acknowledged that, first responders were going down all across the country.
But
when I talked to John Cole, the toxicologist from earlier, he said,
"Well, I don't doubt any of the symptoms that any of these fire, EMS, and police officers have experienced."
He was skeptical.
It's not 100% clear if that's actually due to the fentanyl or to some other event that occurred in those moments.
And John Cole wasn't alone. I mean, I started calling like doctors and toxicologists, pharmacologists, and they said that like the risk that fentanyl posed to first responders was extremely low.
Why? What was their thinking?
Well, for one, I mean, like the powder doesn't spontaneously aerosolize. It doesn't like poof into the air. So that makes like breathing it in pretty unlikely. And as far as the skin-to-skin contact thing,
it's so poorly absorbed.
The like substance itself doesn't pass through the skin easily.
To get fentanyl to absorb through your skin, you have to use a special matrix to be able to,
you know, really, if you want to make a fentanyl patch, you have to sort of use these solvents
to get the absorption to even be to the point where it's therapeutic, let alone an overdose.
Even if you put a fentanyl patch on, it takes a very long time for the drug to sort of like achieve a meaningful dose in the body.
But something is happening to these people. I mean, you have to assume. So if it's not the drugs, what is it?
She says, yeah, what John Cole and a couple of other people brought up was this idea that maybe it wasn't the external situation that they're in. It was more something internal.
There's no question in my mind that every one of these people felt symptoms that are very real.
But John said the symptoms don't really match the symptoms of a typical opioid overdose.
For instance, hyperventilating.
On opioids, you're usually breathing slower.
Not breathing faster.
Or a lot of first responders reported feeling
a sense of great impending doom.
Opiates are all about
serenity and pleasure, not impending doom.
And so if you look at the symptoms and sort of the stories that are being told about these new substances and these new situations in our culture right now, he says it kind of looks like a mass panic.
So there's a condition called mass psychogenic illness.
This is something that John Cole says he's actually come across in his work at the Minnesota Poison Control.
There was a school event and a bunch of...
he said that about 4 or 5 years ago, there was this incident at a public school in Minnesota where a bunch of kids started like keeling over because they thought it was like carbon monoxide poisoning.
Subsequent student after student began to feel ill.
They took all these kids to the hospital and they gave them blood tests.
None of the blood levels were positive for carbon monoxide.
Just didn't check out.
And once the medical conditions are ruled out from a known poison, you have to start considering other causes. And that event was consistent with this condition called mass psychogenic illness.
And so when you think about, you know, first responders showing up at the scene of a drug overdose, and what's running through their mind is this like constant onslaught of news reports and other sort of anecdotal accounts they've heard about their friends and their colleagues that are, you know, passing out.
It isn't that anybody's crazy or weak. It's that their mind is causing them to be physically ill. They really are sick, but it isn't necessarily due to the thing that they believe that it is in the moment. Does that make sense?
My response to that is they...
So we told Scotty what we knew, what these scientists had been saying. And Scotty says basically like, look, they can say whatever they want to in their labs, but this is what I went through.
I just know the effects of that day, that I came in contact with something that put me in an overdosing situation.
Ricky Mays.
An inmate at the Clark County Detention Center, Kentucky. Charges for your call have been accepted.
Hello.
Hi, Ricky. This is Peter Smith. I'm a reporter.
So I ended up sending a postcard to the jail because the jails don't accept letters because they're afraid of drugs getting in. And a week later, I get a call from Ricky Mays. Ricky is Scotty's stepfather, and he's also the person who overdosed, who Scotty Whiteman treated. And he told me that there wasn't a whole lot of toxicology evidence or medical records or much of anything really, but he had agreed to a plea deal for all 10 wanton endangerment charges.
Yes, I pled guilty. That took 3 years. I mean, I was more or less forced. That's it.
You said you were more or less forced?
Yes.
Because Ricky's a repeat felony offender, he was looking at like 20 years instead of the 3 that he took.
More or less, the message you're putting out there is if anybody ODs around you or anything like that, throw them in a ditch and, you know, leave them. That's the message that the court system's putting out to people. That's the way I take it.
And how does that make you feel? I mean, is that...
Not good.
Yeah.
I mean...
As it seems like if they didn't call you, we wouldn't be talking right now.
Do what?
I said if they hadn't called 911 that day, like the Good Samaritan law sort of says you can, it doesn't seem like we'd be talking right now.
They done the right thing.
Yeah.
They're more or less now they're paying for what they done.
Anything else you want to ask? I'm sorry, I just ramble on all day.
Unlike Ricky, Scotty has refused to take a plea deal. Instead, he's going to risk up to 20 years in jail by taking his case to trial.
I think about it every day. Every day at work for at least a couple hours, I think about, and the same answer comes up every day. I have to take it to trial. I mean, I don't want them doing this to, you know, everybody, man. That they're going to be afraid to call 911.
I feel like for me, like, given the way it's gone, given the way people and how they think about drugs, like, I don't know if I would have the same sort of like confidence or conviction.
I understand where you're coming from. That's what my lawyer says too. I think when a few things come to light, you know, like, they may say, well, he did get sick. Well, we're going to say, well, he didn't test positive for anything. Could have been something else. Every little bit of doubt that you create is reasonable doubt to, you know, and all you got to do is convince one person on that jury to say, no, I'm not doing it. That's all you got to do.
Obviously, the jury will be making a decision about the case and about what happened in the apartment that day. But I think there's sort of a bigger, sort of more consequential message that they'll be sending about what people like Scotty and Scotty should believe and what they should fear and what they should do going forward.
If these charges end up getting dismissed or if it goes to trial and the people are found not guilty for one endangerment, like, how are you going to feel?
If they're found not guilty, then I'm going to trust in the judicial system that there was things that come to light that maybe I wasn't aware of. And if they're not found guilty, then yeah, so be it. And if he goes out and uses again and I'm on shift when it happens and I walk in and see him, guess what? I'm going to treat him. My job is to do everything within my power to save his life. And that's what I'm going to do.
And I asked the other Scotty,
would you make the same call? Do you think other people would make the same call? If this is what's on the end of that call, potentially.
They won't make the call. They'll try to, most people, depending on who they are, they'll probably try to just leave the person, drag him outside or something like that. You know, people in jail will say and do that. Or, you know, cover up everything at the crime scene or whatever, you know. Or just not call. Like I said, if I knew there would have been 10 felonies, man, I don't know, man. It's still got a call. The guy can't die. That's what I believe. I really believe that, man.
When Scotty Haddon first got arrested for the wanton endangerment charges, he spent 6 months in jail. After getting out, he now attends church every Sunday with his family.
What are you watching? VeggieTales?
VeggieTales?
He and Jessica have partial custody back of their son, Gabriel.
You like VeggieTales?
What, VeggieTales?
That's a tomato.
That's a tomato.
Yeah, that's a tomato.
That's a tomato.
That's a cucumber.
That's
a... And both he and Jessica...
Judge, I think at this point we probably need to... Go ahead and set a trial date out.
Have pending trials scheduled for December. Okay, reporter Peter Smith and Matt Keelty.
Also, special thanks in this episode to Cecil Lawson and Jason York and Gary Bielert and all the EMTs and the medics who generously allowed us to go around and ride with them, see what they saw.
Exactly. And Todd Tout and John Sunderland, Chris Kipley, Dr. David Yearlink, Dr. Dan Ciccarone, Fiona Thomas, Dr. Ken Williams.
And Corey S. Davis.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Radiolab was created by Jad Abumrad and is edited by Soren Wheeler. Lulu Miller and Latif Nasser are our co-hosts. Dylan Keefe is our director of sound design. Our staff includes Simon Adler, Jeremy Bloom, Becca Bressler, Rachel Cusick, Aketi Foster-Keys, W. Harry Fortuna, David Gable, Maria Paz Gutierrez, Sindhu Nyanasambandan, Matt Keelty, Annie McEwen, Alex Neeson, Sarah Kari, Anna Rasquet Bass, Sarah Sandback, Ariane Wack, Pat Walters, and Molly Webster, with help from Andrew Vinales. Our fact-checkers are Diane Kelly, Emily Krieger, and Natalie Middleton.
Hi, this is Finn calling from Storrs, Connecticut. Leadership support for Radiolab's science programming is provided by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative, and the John Templeton Foundation. Foundational support for Radiolab was provided by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.